CS Insider, a premium edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Today's host is Senior Editor Chris Sheridan.
Jim Rickards joins us on the show today to discuss his new must-read book called Aftermath, Seven Secrets of Wealth Preservation in the Coming Crisis. Jim, the focus on America's debt burden, massive debt burden of $22.5 trillion, it's died down a little bit in recent years. It's not receiving the level of attention that it did right after the 2008 financial crisis, but you draw a significant amount of attention to this subject in your new book. How did we get to where we are today?
Well, it's a great question. Thank you for having me on the program. Yeah, it's funny, you know, when you're a writer, you go back and forth with your publisher and an editor, in my case, Penguin Random House. My editor says, you know, she'll say at different points, you know, Jim, I love what you're doing. I love the chapters, great writing, but where's the thread? It was, where's the thing that runs through the entire book that holds it all together and makes it a book and not just, you know, eight long essays? It's a great question. And the answer is debt. I have an entire chapter just on that, which is chapter two, but debt is one of the threads that runs through the entire book. Because I also talk about the modern monetary theory and the new international monetary system and potential financial collapse, but all those things kind of come back to debt one way or another. So just to sort of summarize, I have a chapter that goes through the entire history of U.S. national debt. And, you know, from a lot of people, it's kind of, oh, please, you know, spare me debt deficits. Nothing's more boring. And they roll their eyes. But hopefully I've been able to tell the story in a way that holds the reader's attention, that is a story and not just a bunch of charts and numbers. And that also gives you a really good foundation and makes it very straightforward to understand. It kind of goes like this. You know, when George Washington became president, a lot of people assume that, well, you know, Washington becomes president in 1789 and there's no national debt, but he borrows some money. And then Thomas Jefferson borrows some money for the Louisiana Purchase. And, you know, Lincoln borrowed money for the Civil War, and we kept borrowing money and the debt kept going up and up and up. And today here we are, and it's $23 trillion, and it's a scary number, and it looks out of control, et cetera. But the assumption behind that is that the debt just kept going up throughout U.S. history, and we are where we are. That's not true. That is not what happened. First of all, when George Washington became president, we had national debt before we had a nation. So Washington gets sworn in, and he inherits debt from the Revolutionary War. And then the question is what to do with it. And the Congress said, well, that's simple. We'll just default. I mean, that's the American way. Just don't pay it. But it was Alexander Hamilton who stepped in and said, no, let's borrow some more money, pay off the old debt. This will establish our credit. We can then borrow more in the future to pay off the new debt. And just keep it going. As long as the economy is growing in a way that supports the debt, we can just keep rolling it over. We don't have to pay it off. We just have to be creditworthy. And that was the origin of the U.S. government bond market, the U.S. Treasury market. And as I say, Alexander Hamilton created it, and it's been going strong ever since for, you know, upwards of 230 years at this point. But that said, it was not the case that the debt kept going up. In fact, what happened was much more of a sine wave. In other words, it would go up, but then it would come down, and then it would go up, and then it would come down. And when I say up and down, I'm measuring it as a percentage of GDP. In other words, what is your debt relative to GDP? Because you can't think of debt, you can't analyze debt in isolation from other factors. For example, if you had a credit card and someone had a $25,000 balance on their credit card, that's how much they owed, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Is it manageable or not? Well, it depends how much money you make. If you're making $20,000 and you've got $25,000 of debt on your credit card, you're in serious trouble. You might be heading for bankruptcy. But if you're making $200,000 a year, it's manageable. You could probably pay it off with one check. In other words, you have to think of the debt in relation to the capacity to pay the debt. And that's, in the case of a country, it's GDP. That's your, you know, your gross domestic product. How much does the country make in effect? So that's how I think about it. I think it's the right way to think about it. But it does have this sine wave I describe where it's up and down and up and down. What is the driver behind that? What is the mechanic or the causal factor between the increase and the decrease? The answer is war. It, generally speaking, and it's very high correlation, it goes up in times of war, and then it goes down in times of peace. So when you look at James Monroe, War of 1812, or James Polk, Mexican-American War, or the Spanish-American War, certainly World War II, we'll talk a little bit more about that, that's when it goes up. Well, those are existential issues. You know, you have to fight the war and win the war and finance it. But then it goes down in times of peace. And this is America saying, we never know when there's going to be another crisis. We never know when there's going to be another war. So we better pay it off and reduce our debt burden when we can, when during prosperous times and times of peace, so that we have that borrowing power. You can call it dry powder, if you like. You build up your weapons in times of peace so you're ready to fight a war. And by the same token, you pay off your debt, build up your borrowing capacity in times of peace so you're ready to borrow when you have to. So that's the driver behind the up and down cycle. And this goes all the way through to, you know, the end of World War II. You know, now, Chris FDR died in office, but at the end of the Roosevelt administration, at the end of World War II, the U.S. debt to GDP ratio was 120%, the highest in U.S. history. Well, okay, that's high, but it's very high. But FDR had the Great Depression, followed by World War II. He had two, you know, a domestic existential crisis and an international war, and had to win both of them. And that explains the debt. But what happened next was fascinating. Over the next 35 years or so, from, let's say, 1945 to 1980, through Republican and Democratic administrations, and this is what impresses me, it was very much of a bipartisan effort, the country got that ratio down from 120% at the end of World War II to 30% at the beginning of the Reagan administration. And again, this was Democrats, you know, Harry Truman, John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and Jimmy Carter, but also Republicans, Dwight Eisenhower, Richard Nixon, and Gerald Ford. In other words, the parties worked together along with the Fed and the Treasury to reduce the debt to GDP ratio when they had the opportunity. And they did so with great success. As I said, they got it down to 30%. And that's consistent with this whole pattern I described going back to 1789. Now, Reagan comes in, and Reagan has this reputation as this, you know, fiscal conservative, et cetera. Not true. Reagan was one of the great big spenders. Reagan took the debt to GDP ratio up again from that low of about 30% to 50% by the time he left office, which is a 60% increase. You go from 30 to 50, that's a 60% increase. But in Reagan's defense, he won the Cold War. I mean, the Cold War had been fought. Everyone deserves credit for going back to 1946. But Reagan provided the critical leadership to win the Cold War. And he did it with Star Wars, a 600-ship Navy, you know, other military expenditures that the Soviets just couldn't keep up with. And they eventually threw in the towel. So Reagan took it up to 50%, but he won the Cold War. What happened next was interesting because you had George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. Again, I want to emphasize these are Republicans and Democrats working together to, in a way that's kind of hard to imagine today because the partisanship is so bitter, but the parties always had their differences and they always fought over elections and you win some and lose some. But on this issue, they worked together. Now, Bush 41 and Clinton did not reduce the deficit a lot in the way I've described, but they kept a lid on it. It didn't go up a lot. And at the end of the Clinton administration, the ratio was a little bit under 60%, but not that far off from where Reagan left it at 50%. So they did not reduce it, but they kept a lid on it. And the national debt when Clinton left office was $5 trillion. Then things ran off the rails, beginning in 2000 with George W. Bush, Bush 41, and through Obama, and now into Trump. This pattern I described has not prevailed. Bush doubled the debt from $5 trillion to $10 trillion. And then from that higher base, Obama doubled it again from $10 trillion to $20 trillion. And then Trump has piled on a couple trillion more since he took office. So now you're closing in on $23 trillion. But as I say, this is off the rails. This breaks the pattern. Okay, Bush, you know, had to respond to 9/11, okay, and the war in Iraq. But the war in Iraq was a war of choice. We didn't have to do that. And then Obama had no new wars of any significance during his term, and Trump hasn't had any so far. That's a good thing, by the way. I'm not rooting for war. I'm making the opposite point, which is when you don't have wars, that's when you get the debt under control. And Bush, Obama, and Trump failed that test. And so now the debt to GDP ratio is 106%. It's back up, getting close to where it was at the end of World War II. But prior to 2000, we had bipartisan competence. Today, we seem to have bipartisan incompetence. And no one's concerned about it. I mean, yeah, 2010, the Tea Party came along and debt, national debt was one of their signature issues. But you haven't heard much about it since then. And, you know, Democrats are only too happy to spend on domestic priorities and, you know, healthcare and welfare programs and so forth. And Republicans are only too happy to spend on defense and their priorities. And some of the priorities are shared. But the result is that it's completely out of control. Now, so the question is, does it matter? And that's when you get into modern monetary theory, which I cover in chapter 5 of the book. So there's a lot more to say about it. But that basic backdrop that the debt to GDP ratio is now out of control, both parties have abandoned any pretense of discipline, and it's skyrocketing in a time of peace in ways that are not sustainable. That's the number one concern. You know, people worry about day-to-day stuff. Yeah, okay, I read the headlines also, but that debt overhang is the biggest single problem in the financial landscape.
You know, it's interesting because as you mentioned, there was a lot of focus on America's debt burden, but particularly after the 2008 financial crisis. And that's a big focus of your book as well, is the aftermath, what took place after the financial crisis, how it was dealt with, and where this is setting us up going forward. But, you know, there was a lot of attention on America's unsustainable debt burden with the Tea Party movement as well. But now it seems like most of the narrative has gone from this is a problem, we need to fix it, to now debating over modern monetary theory and the fact that it's not a problem and perhaps we can just ignore it. And it seems that's about where the collective mindset is now. At least that's the focus and that's where most of the discussion is gravitated toward. So what are your thoughts on how the attention has shifted over time?
Well, first of all, you're exactly right about the coming impact, really, and the current impact of modern monetary theory. There's a little more to it than that. I mean, you've got sort of mainstream Keynesians or neo-Keynesians, so people like Larry Summers and Paul Krugman and Joe Stiglitz and others. They don't agree on everything, but they do agree that we have what they call fiscal headroom, that we could run larger deficits from where we are, and that could give the economy a boost. Then you have Donald Trump. I don't think Donald Trump is a, you know, scholar of fiscal policy, but he knows leverage when he sees it, and he's a real estate developer, and real estate developers don't see too much debt that they don't like. And of course, he's running for reelection. So he's thinking, well, yeah, if we spend more, we'll keep the economy going and I'll get reelected. And he's probably right about that. And then you have the modern monetary theorists, and I'll talk about them in a second. But the point is, Republican, Democrat, mainstream, heterodox, Trump, who's sort of one of a kind, and people with new theories all agree that we can have more debt. So, you know, in the last answer, we went through the history of U.S. debt, and I certainly think it's a problem. There's good evidence that says it is a problem. This is not just gut reaction or I don't like debt. I mean, you look at the brilliant work of Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff in their book, you know, This Time It's Different, but also in their papers, all of which are available, some of them jointly, some of them individually, where they look at hundreds of case studies, and they make it absolutely clear that when your debt to GDP ratio goes above 90%, that's a critical threshold. You go through the looking glass. It's not just more of the same. Below 90%, yeah, that's high. You better do something about it. You sort of look like Angela Merkel, try to keep it under 60%, which is where she wants the European Union to be. But above 90%, something happens, and it's the following. The classic, I mean, I think anyone could intuitively understand that if you borrow a dollar and spend a dollar, you should get a dollar of GDP. Like you spend the money, and okay, you spend it on something. Somebody got the dollar, can defense contractor, construction worker, you know, medical worker, somebody got the dollar. So you get at least a buck of GDP for a dollar borrowing. The Keynesians, of course, say that, no, there's a Keynesian multiplier. You get more than a dollar. If you borrow a dollar and spend the dollar, you might get $1.25 or $1.50 of GDP because, you know, yeah, the recipient gets a buck, but then it takes his wife out to dinner or buys something, furniture, appliance, you name it. And then that keeps rippling through and you get more than a dollar of GDP. That's the famous Keynesian multiplier. But what Reinhart and Rogoff show is that that's not true when you get past 90%. You borrow a dollar and spend a dollar, you actually get less than a dollar of GDP. The debt itself becomes a headwind. Maybe the person you spent the dollar on gets a buck, but everyone else is looking at this horror show and saying, they got to pay this off. I better save more. They're going to increase taxes. Again, that's a reason to save more. You get into the liquidity trap. The psychology changes. There's adaptive behavior. There are a whole lot of dynamics that take place. And again, this is very well illustrated in their research, that you actually get less than a dollar of GDP. And that's what people mean when they say you can't borrow your way out of a debt crisis. The Keynesians would say, of course you can. Why not? Well, the answer is above 90%, you can't, and you're heading for default. Now, we can talk about default because there are different ways to do it, including inflation, but that actually you're in that critical zone. Well, that's where we are now. Debt to GDP under Trump and his predecessors is 106%, way past that 90% critical threshold. So we're in a stage now where you cannot borrow your way out of this crisis. In fact, you're actually hurting growth. And it's one of the reasons why growth has been so weak. I mean, we're in the 11th year of an expansion. Started in June 2009. It's the longest expansion in U.S. history, but it's also the weakest expansion in U.S. history. Average growth for the net 10-plus years is about 2.2%. Relative to longer-term trends that show the U.S. can grow at 3.2% or higher. That's a big difference. I mean, one percentage point doesn't sound like a lot, but we're talking about GDP. I mean, GDP is always in a range of kind of negative 5 to plus 5. Both of those are extreme. And the difference between 2% and 3%, or, you know, 2.2 and 3.2, compounded over 10 years is $5 trillion. That's how much lost wealth the U.S. economy has suffered because we can't get back to trend growth. And that's how much richer we would be. We'd have another $5 trillion of wealth in the economy, some of which would go to the government, of course, if we had been able to get back to trend growth. But we can't. And one of the reasons we can't is this debt overhang, which is not going away. Now, having said all of that, this neo-Keynesian thesis is discredited by the data. The data actually shows that we cannot grow our way out of it, cannot borrow our way out of it. The only solution then is inflation. But think about the fact the Fed's been trying to get inflation for 10 years and can't do it. I mean, it's a sad day when a central bank wants inflation and can't get it. Fed has a 2% inflation target. They have a particular measure. It's a PC deflator core year over year. But leaving aside that technicality as to their chosen metric, they have only hit 2% once in the last 7 years and couldn't hold it. It went back down again. Today, it's around 1.6%. So we can't even... I'm not saying inflation is an attractive option. I am saying it might be the only option, and we can't get the inflation. So we're just heading for default with slow growth along the way to make it even worse. Now, here come the modern monetary theorists. What do they say? They say, what's the problem? You know, it used to be when you had programs and politicians would come out and they'd say, oh, well, you know, let's forgive all the student debt. Let's have free healthcare, free childcare, free tuition, Green New Deal, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And there used to be a very simple way to rebut those proposals. You would just say, well, that's fine, all very interesting, but we can't afford it. And we just can't afford it. And everyone would go, yeah, you're right, we can't afford it. Well, today, when you say the same thing, the proponents of these giveaways, you say we can't afford it, they look at you and say, yes, we can. And that comes from modern monetary theory, which says the following, that first of all, they do some crazy stuff. And I've actually read all this scholarship, so I've kind of gone beyond the headlines, if you will, and read their academic papers and books. The first thing they do is they merge the balance sheets of the Treasury and the Fed. Now, that's not the legal standing. Treasury is an executive branch department, and the Fed's an independent agency with separate rules, et cetera. But they merge them together, and they say, look, no problem. We can spend money on anything we want. We can make the deficits as high as we want. The Treasury can just borrow the money. And if the bond market gets a little balky, the Fed can buy the bonds, monetize the debt, stash it away on their balance sheet for 10 years, collect at maturity. What's the problem? And when you put it that way, it has a kind of superficial appeal. And this is the problem. A lot of people are nice and say, yeah, what's the problem? And they go, look at Japan. Their debt to GDP ratio is about 250%. Ours is only 106. We got lots of headroom. We can go much, much further down this road. And so when you say the Fed can monetize the debt, which they can, and there's no legal limit on the Fed's balance sheet, nor do they need capital, which is true. Might be unattractive, but it's true. And, you know, the Congress will always go along with the debt ceiling so the Treasury can actually borrow the money. What's the problem? And to prove it, I'll put the word prove in quotation marks, they look to Ben Bernanke. They say, look, Bernanke proved it. Bernanke printed almost $4 trillion between 2008 and 2014. Now, he did it for different reasons. He didn't do it for the Green New Deal. He did it to have zero interest rates, prop up bank earnings. You know, if my cost of funds is zero and I can invest at 2%, leverage at 10 to 1, I have a 20% return on equity. I mean, what's not to like? But that was to bail out the banks and keep Jamie Dimon's bonus in high positive territory. But what the MMT people say is, well, you know, Bernanke proved you can do it. There was no inflation, no significant amount of inflation. The world didn't come to an end. There was no financial panic. He did it to prop up Jamie Dimon's bonus, but we can do it for Medicare for All and free tuition and all the rest. It's a different purpose, but it's the same technique. Again, I found when I encountered MMT and studied it, I found it was actually difficult to rebut, or at least I had to give it a lot of thought because it did have all this superficial appeal. But here's the answer. Here's the flaw that they don't look. Well, there are several. The first one, going back to the history of U.S. debt, it was never considered advisable to push the debt to the limit. In theory, the U.S. could have borrowed more money in World War II or the Civil War for that matter. And the reason they always reduced it is they wanted that headroom if they needed it. It was dry powder for an emergency that you couldn't quite foresee. Now, Professor Kelton at State University of New York, Stony Brook, she's the big brain on this. She's the leading advocate for modern monetary theory. Met her, know her, very nice lady, very smart and articulate. By the way, she's also the chief economic advisor to Bernie Sanders' 2020 campaign. So we'll see how Sanders does. But if he wins, you should expect to see Stephanie in the Treasury Department or OMB or someplace fairly significant. But the point is, she says, well, we can just borrow as much as we want. There's no limit on this. But, if a little inflation shows up, we have a cure for that. We'll just raise taxes. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, that's interesting. So you have a debt crisis, rising inflation, and a tax increase. That sounds like a real recipe for economic growth. But that is her answer. But what they're all ignoring, again, this is where I came to, that what the MMT people are ignoring is the psychological limit, not the legal limit. It is true that the Fed can borrow as much as they want, but there's a psychological limit. There's a what physicists call a critical threshold or a phase transition, and behavioral psychologists have a name for it. But it's basically, you just wake up one day and say, you know what? I'm out of here. I don't know what's going on. I don't trust this. This is out of control. Get me out of dollars. I'll buy gold, I'll buy silver, fine art, land, buy a new car, buy some new appliances, whatever, do whatever I can, but get me out of the dollar because I've just lost confidence. And when that happens, and by the way, something very similar did happen in 1977. I lived through that. People like to say, since the creation of the Fed in 1913, the dollar has lost 95% of its purchasing power. Well, that's true, but the economists say, yeah, but your incomes are up, your stock prices are up, your house prices are up. So you had a lot of assets to offset that loss of purchasing power, so stop complaining. There are problems with that analysis, but having to do with income inequality, but we can leave that to one side. But in a very compressed period, 5 years from 1977 to 1981, the value of the dollar dropped over 50%. That's 50% not in 100 years, but in 5 years. Well, and that came out of the blue. No one was really expecting that at the time, but that was a change in behavior, change in psychology, increase in velocity. Well, that can happen again. And if it happens that quickly, tax increase is not going to put the genie back in the bottle. People are just going to – there is a cure for it, by the way. It's what Paul Volcker did, raise interest rates to 20%, throw the economy into the worst recession since the Great Depression at the time. That'll cure the inflation, but a tax increase won't because there are legitimate ways around tax increases. So I think Professor Kelton and other advocates, and this includes Paul McCulley, former number two guy at PIMCO, Warren Mosler, very successful hedge fund manager. And I've met most of them and spoken to them personally about this. They have a kind of naive trust in the ability of tax increases to control inflation. There's really not much correlation there. They have a naive trust in the ability to take these ratios much higher without adverse consequences. And above all, they're ignoring the lesson of history, which is keep some dry powder. Yeah, maybe you can borrow more, but you want to have that available. Don't use it up for no good reason. So, there are plenty of flaws in it psychologically, historically, and economically, but those flaws are not being discussed. I talk about it in my book. I have a whole chapter on this, chapter 5, but I haven't seen the analysis I just gave anywhere else. And I do think it's important to get that message out there because MMT, if you're a politician, again, what's not to like? Some really bright economist named Stephanie Kelton is just giving you a rationale for spending as much money as you like on all your favorite programs. So as I say, what's not to like?
Yeah. And, it's really interesting because basically you make the point that after 230 years of prudent debt management, the U.S. national debt has now grown to the point where it's clearly non-sustainable at over 100% debt to GDP. It doesn't appear that that's going to be reduced or that trend is going to move in the other direction anytime soon. So MMT is basically like a rationalization of this continuing trend. I imagine it's just going to be embraced by the economics community, if not in the next economic cycle, maybe two economic cycles, who knows? One thing that you discuss is what foreigners are doing. They are clearly aware of this situation and they're making steps to prepare for when something bad happens. They see this as non-sustainable. So tell us a little bit about how foreigners view America's debt burden and what they're doing in response.
Sure. And there are two big vectors there, two aspects to that. The first one is that, you know, they're looking at it just the way we're discussing right now. There are only three ways out. Default, which is not going to happen because we can print the money. Growth, you can grow your way out of it, but that's not happening because the debt burden is already too high. And we talked about that with the Reinhardt and Rogoff research. The third way out is the all-American way, which is inflation. Well, inflation actually does work. It reduces the real value of the debt. You increase nominal GDP. You know, when it comes to debt to GDP, you know, everyone talks about real GDP. And yeah, that's the one you should focus on. But when you talk about debt, you have to look at nominal GDP because debt is nominal. If I owe you a dollar, I owe you a dollar. It's interesting whether it's worth more or less because of inflation or deflation. But, you know, a dollar is a dollar. So you need to look at the nominal side. And one of the ways to get growth up is inflation. So even if you only have 2% real growth, if you can get 4%, 5% inflation, all of a sudden you have 6 or 7% nominal growth. And that could be slightly higher than the growth in debt, which for the time being is only about, it's about 5%. It's way more than the nominal growth. So inflation works. But if you're the Chinese and you're holding $1.4 trillion of U.S. Treasury obligations, or you're the Japanese and you're holding something that's now approaching $1 trillion of U.S. Treasury obligations, what do you think of inflation? Well, you're the loser. If you hold that debt and inflation comes along, you got a, you know, a 10-year note yielding 2% to maturity, and here comes 5% inflation, your capital is getting wiped out. So they're watching it very, very closely. They don't want to dump U.S. treasuries. They don't want to do that. First of all, they wouldn't get very far if they caused any kind of economic difficulty. The president could freeze their accounts with one phone call, and that legislative authority exists. The Congress wouldn't have to do anything. The president can be a kind of financial dictator when it comes to labeled national security threats. And Trump is not shy about using it. So you can't dump them. But what you can do is sort of ease out of them by just not buying as many. So when old notes come to maturity, so you bought a 10-year note 10 years ago, maturity, the Treasury just sends you the money. Well, what you can do is you don't have to go out and buy a new 10-year note. You could buy euros, you could buy gold, you could buy a lot of things. And what the Chinese in particular are doing, and the Russians in a striking way, is buying gold. Russia in the last 10 years has more than tripled its gold reserves from 600 tons to approaching 2,300 tons. China likewise has more than tripled its gold reserves from 600 tons to now approaching 2,000 tons, although there's good reason to believe the Chinese actually have more. They're just non-transparent about it. But either way, those are huge increases in their gold. In the case of Russia, Russia now has more than 20% of its total reserves in gold. Russian reserves are about 400 billion. And as I say, 20% of that, or 80 billion, is in gold. So why are they doing that? Are they stupid, or do they see something coming that maybe not very many people see? Well, they're not stupid. I spent a lot of time in Russia and China. I have friends in both countries. I've dealt with government officials and economists in both places. They're not stupid. I mean, national sport of Russia is chess, and the Chinese have a Confucian ethic. So they're thinking long term. But they do see something coming that most people don't, and they're hedging their bets, and they're preparing for inflation, which they think is inevitable, by buying gold. In the case of Russia, they're actually reducing their U.S. Treasury holdings. In the case of China, they're kind of treading water, but they're not buying more. But there's another reason, which is the U.S. has weaponized the dollar. The U.S. is fighting financial wars all over the world. You know, recently, Iran shot down a U.S. drone, and everyone was waiting for Trump to fire some cruise missiles into the Iranian control center in retaliation for that attack. And it never happened. And everyone said, well, thank goodness we avoided a war. Sorry, we're in a war. The war started a while ago. The war started over a year ago. It's just a financial war. It's not a shooting war. We have kicked Iran out of the global payment system. We have embargoed their oil exports. They cannot get hard currency because they can't sell the oil. You know, the UK just seized an Iranian oil tanker that seemed to be headed for Syria. They said, sorry, turn around. That vessel was seized. They're getting hyperinflation in Iran. The central bank has to, you know, there's the flood of deposits coming out of the banking system. The currency is devalued 50%. The central bank is raising interest rates to keep the deposits in the banks. That's costly and causing the economy to decline. They can't get imported goods. This is a mess. We're headed for regime change in Iran without firing a shot, using financial weapons. Same thing Russia with Crimea and Eastern Ukraine, China with the tariffs, Venezuela with embargoes. You look around the world, we're fighting financial wars everywhere. Now, that's good. If you want to throw your weight around, I guess it's better than a shooting war. And it's not just the dollar and the payment system, which we talked about, but limits on foreign investment in the United States, tariffs, embargoes, account freezes, seizures, et cetera. Those are your financial weapons, and they're actually the list is longer than that. Well, if you're on the receiving end of that, you're Iran, Russia, China, North Korea, Syria, Venezuela, or even other countries, how long are you going to put up with that? My analogy is, a metaphor is, it's like the schoolyard bully. You know, one day the bully beats up a kid, and the next day he beats up another kid, and then the next day he beats up another kid. But one day the bully shows up, and all the kids have banded together and formed a gang, and they beat the stuffing out of the bully. So pushback happens eventually. People don't just take it lying down beyond a certain point. And so what Russia and China are doing, in addition to the gold reserves, which is an inflation hedge, as I mentioned, they're building a what's called a permission distributed ledger. And that's just a fancy name for a blockchain. But the key word is permissioned, meaning you can only use it if they say so. So, you know, a Bitcoin, for example, I'm not a big fan of Bitcoin, but anybody can use that blockchain. Anybody can mine Bitcoin. Anybody can use the blockchain, et cetera. But a permissioned blockchain means that you can only use it if we say so. So Russia and China are building this. They're creating a new cryptocurrency. You can call it Putin coin or Xi coin if you want. Again, I'm clear. I'm not talking about Bitcoin or Ether or Ripple or all these other things, which again, I don't think much of. But a new coin, it would be what's called a stable coin, meaning the value would be pegged to something. Now, I'm not clear what the something is. It could be the special drawing right, the SDR. It could be a weight in gold. It could be a lot of things. But so you create the new coin. You put it on a permissioned ledger. You have a stable value by equating it to something. But for the icing on the cake, you periodically settle your balance of payments in gold, in physical gold. So who would be in this network? Well, it's day one would be, you know, Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, Turkey, Venezuela, some other countries. And you create a, but maybe over time, you know, you'd invite Brazil and India, and maybe China would put pressure on Hong Kong, and Hong Kong would join. Of course, that's a major financial center, maybe Korea, et cetera. So you'd add to the list, and you create a trading network. So now Iran sells oil to China. China sells infrastructure to Russia. Russia sells natural gas to China. Everybody takes a vacation in Turkey, you know, and so on. And you have this whole trading network, all of which is bought and paid for in these new coins. Digital coins or digital tokens, which is really just a way to keep score. It's not highly significant in and of itself. You can keep score with baseball cards, but you'd keep score. But periodically, as you know, one country had a surplus with another country, or you would receive gold to settle that surplus. And you could fly it around. You could put it on a plane and move it around, but you could put all the gold in a central depository, maybe Switzerland, Dubai, someplace, and just change the name tags, which is what has been going on with gold for a long time. But my point being, what's missing from that system I just described? The dollar. There are no dollars. You're not using the dollar payment system. You're not using dollars. You're not relying on U.S. banks. You don't have it at the end of the day. You don't have a digital asset because your gold is physical and it can't be erased or hacked or otherwise diverted. And this will be a rude awakening for the U.S. By the way, I've spoken to the U.S. Treasury and national security officials about this. It's not like this is all in my book, but you know, I have a duty as an American to alert the U.S. government to this. And I have, although they don't really take the threat very seriously. I do, but my opinion doesn't matter. What matters is the Russians and the Chinese. So judge them from their own actions. But these things are coming. This is not, you know, 21st century science fiction. It's actually happening. These things have all been announced. The gold purchases are real. The cryptocurrency development is real. They're building an internet just among themselves, so it would be harder to interdict the message traffic. Encryption is the easiest part of the whole thing. This is coming down the path very quickly, and the U.S. is not ready for it.
Jim, there's so many different directions I would love to take this interview, especially given just the wealth of subjects and insights that you offer in your book. I think one last thing that I would like to leave with is, given the fact that we just had a number of Democratic presidential candidates debating over income equality and trying to reach greater levels of equality in American society, you have a very fascinating portion of your book where you discuss the great leveling and, unfortunately, what it seems to be the inability to actually bring about income equality or to reduce the wealth gap. If you wouldn't mind, share that portion of your book with us.
Thank you. I'd be glad to. And this was based on a number of sources, but one in particular is a book called The Great Leveling by Walter Scheidel, who's a scholar, but really more of an historian and a bit of an anthropologist, more so than an economist. But he writes about the toughest topic in economics, which is income inequality. And there's sort of good news and bad news. The good news is there is something you can do about income inequality. It does go away from time to time. The bad news is there are only four things that make it go away. The first is mass mobilization warfare with mass casualties in the tens of millions. The second is revolution, and not a small one, but a big one that wipes away a society, sort of what the communists did in China. The third is a plague or natural catastrophe. And the fourth is a systemic collapse. And here you're kind of into complexity theory. Sometimes things just collapse. They just fall down in very unforeseeable ways. So the cure is worse than the disease. I mean, income inequality is a serious problem in society, but I'm not sure I'd like to sign up for, 50 million casualties or half the population of the earth dying out or a civilizational collapse in order to get rid of it. But just to give concrete examples, and by the way, he goes back to Paleolithic times. So it's not, a lot of scholars would stop at, ancient civilizations or Sumerians or whatever. He's, let's just go back to the caveman and see how that worked out. But one of the great episodes of leveling when income inequality was, very much wiped out, very much reduced, was after the Black Plague. Of course, the Black Plague was in 14th century Europe, and it wiped out, estimates vary, but somewhere between a third and half the population. So you kill half the population in Europe with a plague. Guess what? There's a labor scarcity. So labor's demanded higher wages. And from the mid 14th century until well into the 15th century, workers got paid a lot more because there weren't as many of them and people still needed to build stuff and do stuff. And with everyone wiped out, the survivors got higher wages. Another episode was in the 1950s, 1960s in the United States, and actually a lot of the developed world, but the United States in particular. Well, why was that? Well, we went through World War II, 50 million dead, and Europe in ruins and Japan in ruins. Well, you had to rebuild all that with not nearly as many workers available. So workers got raises. They had unions and got good raises and benefits. So income inequality is cured, but it's cured by one of these types of disasters where, the cure is worse than the disease. But it does happen. But his bigger point is that absent a plague or a mass war or a systemic collapse or a revolution, it doesn't go away. Now, there are lots of proposals for it, guaranteed basic income, free tuition, earlier education, more access to education, more meritocracy. There are solutions, but they never get enacted. Why? Because the people, this is the problem with income inequality, the people running the system, running the legislatures, running the universities are the very people who are the biggest beneficiaries of income inequality. So why would they want to change a system where they benefit? If you have a really fantastic education at Ivy League schools or whatever, guess what? Your kids go to Ivy League schools. If you went to some private school, odds are good your child's going to go to that private school. So et cetera. So it becomes self-perpetuating. And the last thing you're going to do is rock the boat and give anyone else a hand up. So the point being, there are theoretical policy cures, but they never get enacted because the people who benefit from income inequality are in charge of the system. There are other things that do work, but they come unexpectedly and they are disastrous, but income inequality goes away, but it goes away in ways that are very, very costly.
Well, Jim, I want to thank you for being generous with your time today to discuss your new book. Again, the title is Aftermath, 7 Secrets of Wealth Preservation in the Coming Chaos. There's a lot of material that you discuss. We only really hit the surface of it. And what you said was obviously very insightful, even in today's interview. Anything that we didn't discuss today that you'd like to tease out for our audience that is in the book that they'll be presented with if they pick up a copy?
Very quickly, when people say aftermath, kind of what does the title mean and what does it refer to? Well, it refers to two things. One is we're still in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis. I know it was 10 years ago or more and the economy has been expanding, et cetera, but none of the problems have been solved. All that happened was that the debt and the leverage was moved up from the private sector to the central banks. but who's going to bail out the central banks next time we have a problem? So that's one issue. And I also talk about what's sometimes called the reset. I prefer the word reform, but whatever it is, it's a new international monetary system. And as I mentioned, I'm actually going to be in Bretton Woods next week. July 23rd, 2019 is the publication date of my book, but it's also the exact 75th anniversary of the original Bretton Woods. It was July 23rd, 1944, when they came up with their agreement. And I'll be at the Mount Washington Hotel, which is where Bretton Woods conference took place. Peter Thiel and others have booked the entire hotel. It's invitation only, so you can't just kind of walk in. But interesting group. It'll be Larry Summers, Harvard, Gillian Tett of the Financial Times, Ben Steele of the Council on Foreign Relations, Peter Thiel, I mentioned, founder of PayPal and Palantir, Stephanie Kelton, we talked about from Modern Monetary Theory, will all be there. And it's not an official government meeting, of course, but we'll be talking about the future of the international monetary system. But I have a whole chapter on this where I sketch out several possible solutions or several possible changes. But here's the big question. I'll leave you with this. Will some convening power, such as the President of the United States and maybe in conjunction with China, call a conference? And I call this chapter the Mar-a-Lago Accord. I mean, why not have it at Mar-a-Lago? It could be anywhere. But sit down at the table and take as much time as you need to rework the system, something I've spoken to Ben Bernanke and the head of the IMF and others about. Or will we have a crisis and a panic and have to do the same thing on an ad hoc emergency basis, which is about the worst possible way to make any decision? I encourage the former, but I expect the latter. I think we'll probably be doing this in crisis and it won't be a pretty picture.
Well, Jim, thanks again for coming on to our show. Definitely want to encourage all of our listeners to pick up a copy of Aftermath. It was a very riveting read, a page turner for being nonfiction, financial, and economics focused. Definitely liked all the parts that you had on complexity theory, weaponization of behavioral psychology, choice architecture, a lot of other subjects that I think are going to be very interesting for our readers. So all the best, and I'm sure this is going to be a bestseller for sure.
Thank you.
Jim, thanks for coming on and speaking with us about your new book. So definitely would say it's a must read. Jim Rickards is probably one of the smartest guys out there when it comes to understanding the financial system, the international monetary system, geopolitical risks. He makes a lot of provocative statements in this book that will definitely get you thinking. And he also doesn't hold back any blows for either the right or the left when it comes to how both political parties have got us to where we are today. If you have any questions on what we discussed today, any comments or feedback, feel free to email me at cris@financialsense.com. If you're listening to this podcast from our website, feel free to click the link where you can buy this book on Amazon, give it a review. Again, the title is Aftermath, 7 Secrets of Wealth Preservation in the Coming Chaos. I'm Chris Sheridan. You're listening to FS Insider.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.